So today I want to talk about, oops. Okay, let's try it again. Are we without echo now?
I think it's just
the speaker on your computer.
Is
the actual computer? Okay, let me talk again. Oh. Here we go. This is the ongoing. Is the television sound on? Okay. So maybe I'll talk about the practice of patience today. Okay. No. Okay.
Yay.
All right. I don't know what you did, but thank you very much. Can you guys hear me? Yes. Good. Okay. So we practice patience. And today I want to talk about friendship and the self and practice. Okay. So the talk is kind of two parts. We may stop in the middle and have some question and answers if you have it. I was reading an article recently about friendship, and I thought it was a great model for how we relate to and develop our practice and how we grow and mature. But then I thought, sometimes we can get confused about when we talk about relationship between the self and things, and sometimes we can get confused about what we're talking about, what the context is. So I'm going to start by talking about the nature of the self, what it is, what it is not, and how we can even think about a relationship to practice. That seems to imply that there's us and then there's something else we're relating to, right? Yeah. So in order to do that, we have to talk about two central aspects. So forgive me if I'm a little geeky here, but I think it's important. These are inextricably linked teachings. And we could talk a long time, and maybe we will in a class sometimes, about the philosophical developments and how the different traditions go about regarding these points. But I'll just try and keep it brief. So the first point is that the self is not a fixed entity. This should be familiar to most of us. That is, it does not have a permanent nature. It's not separate from all of reality. In fact, there is no separate entity we can find anywhere. When we take the time to look closely at our lives, at ourselves, and at the things, and we reflect on what we find, it becomes more and more clear that interdependence is the nature of things, that this inextricably interwoven nature of all aspects of life is the reality that we live in. People, rocks, trees, dogs, songs, ideas, everything that you can encounter or imagine. Deeper than we can imagine. deeper than anything we can identify. Interdependence always goes deeper, deeper, deeper. This is the teaching of Atman and the teachings of emptiness, sunyata, in anatman and sunyata in Buddhism. There's no fixed permanent self. There's no own being. There's only this dynamic interplay. Even if we say dynamic interplay, it sounds like there's different things interplaying with one another, right? And so that's not enough. So this is a radical teaching. It challenges us to realize our lives differently than we usually do. The Dalai Lama said once, you know, it's like being hit by a lightning bolt when we actually get this. It's the point of it, however, is not to get hit by a lightning bolt. The point of it is to liberate us from limited ideas. It's a compassionate teaching. Dogen, the founder of our school, is very clear about this. So I thought I'd read you a couple things. This is from a school called Zenki, Undivided Activity. Life is, for example, like people sailing in a boat. Although we set sail, steer our course, and pull the boat along, the boat carries us and we do not exist apart from the boat. By sailing the boat, we make the boat what it is. Study assiduously this very time. At such a time, there is nothing but the world of the boat. The heavens, the water, and the shore all become the boat's time. Hence, I make life what it is, and life makes me what I am. In riding the boat, one's body and mind, the self and world, are together the dynamic function of the boat. The entire earth and the whole empty sky are in company with the boat's vigorous exertion. Such is the I that is life and the life that is I. So notice he's talking about this interdependence here, this vital interdependent activity. He's also, and this is the second point I'm going to make later, not denying that there's someone in the boat. That someone is not somehow evaporated by this teaching. Another quote I want to give you. This is from Uibutsu Yobutsu. What Buddha means by the self is precisely the entire universe. Thus, whether one is aware of it or not, there is no universe that is not this self. So who we think we are in this very limited way is indeed limited. So this is an essential ongoing lifelong practice, understanding that when we drive our car, when we go to the grocery store, this is the boat's dynamic activity. This is this interplay. And we as individuals do exist. We are not non-existent. We exist just as everything else exists. It is the how we exist that is the question. The Buddha never rejected the notion of a self. And he used the first person pronoun, I, all the time. In the early Buddhist teachings, the Buddha teaches anatman, which I referred to before, and at the same time uses the Pali word atta, Sanskrit atman, and pugala or pudgala in Sanskrit frequently. When he's telling stories, he talks about people that existed. He refers to himself as an I. He refers to particularity. In other words, the existence of particular persons is not denied by the teachings of Anatma. Dogen emphasizes this particularity over and over and over and over. In his uses of the term ipogujin, total exertion of a single thing, or ipotsu, total experience of a single thing, he says, the total experience of a single thing does not deprive a thing of its own particularity. It places a single thing neither against others nor against none. So in other words, a single thing has its own particularity fully. To know the emptiness of a phenomenon does not deprive it of its particular in its existence. Dogen points to us as individual people, talking directly, advising, guiding us on how to practice. He says, for example, in Shishobo, four methods of guidance for the Bodhisattva. Working for welfare of all beings means that you contrive ways to benefit all sentient beings. In other words, you carefully consider the various means which will be most congenial to their well-being. So there's an I there, and there's an other beings there. And not only that, he's asking us to pay attention to what that particular circumstance, that particular person needs. If Dogen didn't regard beings as real entities who suffer and struggle and did not regard us as beings who have an obligation to respond, to benefit ourselves and others, he would not enjoin us to relate to them in this way. He would not emphasize over and over and over the particularity and the reality of this life. So, this is always my question. So what? What does this mean to us? Why should we care about this? We can talk about all these words and phrases and all this stuff, but actually, why? Why listen? Why it's a great morning, not a morning to go to the beach, but well, I kind of like the beach on a great morning, I don't know about you. But what does this mean for us in our lives? It means that we and songs and dogs and rocks and chairs and everything we encounter or can imagine exist as a manifestation of interdependence. Everything is there to teach us. Everything is a living expression of this compassionate reality that we live in. Everything, including ourselves, deserves care, respect, compassion, engagement. Everything is a real reality that is also empty of an impermanent fixed existence. That means we and everything not only can change, we will change. This is our reality. The great Dogen scholar Heejee Kim said, the crucially important thing to note is that in Dogen, opposites or dualities are not obliterated or even blurred. They are not so much transcended as realized. The absolute freedom in question, which is what we're talking about in our lives, right? Absolute freedom, freedom from suffering, freedom to express ourselves fully. What that means is this dynamic activity with all other beings. The absolute freedom in question here is that freedom which realizes itself in duality, not apart from it. In Dogen's view, the dualistic world remains real, not dissolved. So we are liberated to this world that needs our care so badly. We do not eliminate difference. We don't need to eliminate difference. Difference is to be cherished. We realize ourselves in the particularity and the duality and the messiness of this world. The point is we're liberated from constricted, suffering states of being where we cling to illusions about who we are what we are. So when we reflect deeply on interrelatedness, emptiness of inherent existence, we look deeply at what we conceive of as ourselves, what stories we tell ourselves, what habits we have. And we come to know and taste the unique particularity of our lives more and more vividly. And we realize this in the particularity of this world. So this perspective, this dual vision, gives us the freedom to take up our lives and our practice in a relational reality that affirms both these facts. We realize our particularity through and in the truth of interdependence. So this is gritty, messy. It's this heart of transformation of our practice. It's a paradox that we return to over and over again. And when we do that, we come alive in a certain way. We are alive to our foibles, our screwy notions, our habits, our talents, our gifts, our voices. We're humbled. We're alive. We're responsible. We're steady. We're vigorous. We're engaged. So with this background, we can talk about things like our relationship with our practice without making a fundamental mistake to think that we're a permanent fixed over entity here, and we're going to take up this practice over here that's presumably going to fix this mess of a permanent self over here, right? We've got this problem. It's called a self. And then we're going to take up this practice and it's going to fix it. Right? Does anybody ever think that way? It's pretty common. If we could just fix it, this permanent self, we could just make this into this other thing that's going to be another thing, then we would be free of suffering. But it's not like that. It's when we find this living interdependence, engaged with all beings, responsive with all beings, that practice comes alive. So the liberation is not what we think. Yeah. And then we make the mistake once again and again. We refer to ourselves and think of ourselves as fixed being. But you know, the thing is, the mistakes are also included. There's no getting away from it. There's no way that you can get away from the reality of fluidity and interdependence. So I want to talk about friendship and practice in this context, but I also want to give you a chance to ask some questions now, which we usually don't do in the middle of a lecture, but any... one of the reasons I like this is because it keeps us out of an abstraction and helps deliver us to a way of engaging in this messy, gritty, delightful process. It's a model that supports engagement. So let's think about friendship. Friendship can be casual, circumstantial, limited. So you say hello to a neighbor, a clerk at your grocery store, a coworker, or might be more long-term coworker that, you know, I certainly have people in my life that I've worked with and I've never seen them again. It can be deep and short-lived. So I'm thinking of a person you sat next to in the waiting room every day when you had radiation therapy for 10 weeks, or perhaps someone you met traveling or on a retreat that you had a very profound experience with, but then they're gone. Or it can be central, deep, long-lasting, someone who has been with you in sick, in sin. A good friend knows us well. They have our best interests at heart. They support us. They challenge us. These kinds of friendships require honesty, kindness, strength of character, a willingness to be open, a sense of mutuality based on respect and care. To build a relationship of friendship, we need to place it in the realm of things we care about. So we are aware of the relationship, it doesn't slip off our radar for long. So when we think about this in terms of practice, we can ask ourselves, is this a casual relationship based on occasionally being thrown together? Like you're down at Bookshop Santa Cruz and you see a book that looks kind of interesting and you pick it up and you read a few pages and you say, that's kind of nice. Thank you. Or you're driving cross country and you're bored and you listen to a podcast. And you're like, oh, that's pretty good. I like that. Thank you. See you. Or it could be a friendship based on urgent need. Perhaps you heard about Buddha's practice and tried it, but now something's happened. You've had a major loss, a job, a person, home. You're lonely and scared for some reason. Or perhaps you meet a person or a teaching that in an unexpected way that draws you. So there's something compelling happening. Then this could be short-lived too. Or this is becoming a long-standing and important friendship that you want to tend to. You've been studying and are practicing for some time and you want to pay attention to the quality and depth of this relationship. So each of these is fine. There's nothing better or worse. It's just as fine to say hello to a neighbor and have a quick chat about the weather and leave it at that, or bond deeply with someone for a short period of time. And then when it's over, it's over. Or you have a deep relationship with, and you nourish and sustain that. Each of these is good. We need a lot of variety. But when I was reading this article on developing friendship, a few things stood out to me, because long-standing friendships have a certain gift to us. So one thing that they pointed out is that we are all risk-averse to one degree or another. And forming a new friendship requires that we have a sense that we will not be rejected. In terms of practice, what I thought was, our relationship to practice cannot be determined by corrosive ideas that we have about ourselves, that we're incapable, or that deep practice is for someone else, someone smarter, someone more able-bodied, someone who's not distracted and doesn't think when they sit down and sit zazen. So this way of thinking will not allow us to get within 10 feet of practice, or it'll keep us hovering at a distance, always wary, always judging. So an antidote to these corrosive ideas is just to take a thought experiment. Imagine your practice as an endlessly welcoming and patient entity. something that welcomes friendship and accepts you as you are. Because practice does include everything. That's the truth. So we say, come as you are. In that kind of relationship, we find stability. We find the capacity in ourselves to include everything because we're being taught in this positive relationship. If practice, and by that I mean meditation, I also mean just having the teachings occur to you in your everyday life, tackling your negative habits, establishing a relationship with reality that's solid and fluid and alive. So if that scares you, ease into it. There's no need to jump off a cliff. Make brief regular visits. Come to know what the relationship is like on your own terms, at your own speed. Begin to see the ideas you have about practice and how they vary from what it actually is. If you have questions, talk to a teacher, friend, a guide to check out your assumptions. So what I'm talking about here is we're just playing with our imagination. We're saying, what would a deep friendship with practice actually be like? What scares me about it? What draws me about it? So if it seems like you want to build a relationship, a friendship with practice, there are some key common sense things that they talk about in terms of developing friendships. First, make regular times to meet. Have coffee dates, right? Make them a priority along with other key aspects of your life. So in terms of your practice, it can mean different things. If you're nearby and you can, come to the Zendo on a regular basis. If you're not, or it doesn't work, find a regular time to sit zazen, or read, or reflect, or do things around the house with care and awareness. Make it regular. This is not about necessarily going up to the mountains for 3 months. It's about what can I do on a regular basis. Second, these regular times do not need to be long. One of the stories that was included in this article was told by a journalist who stopped by the desk of a colleague to ask a question at a very busy time. Very busy time. You can imagine like a press room. And this friend has had a deadline coming up. So this journalist, one, goes and stops by the desk of her colleague to ask a question. And the person at the desk turns to her and says, I've always got 5 minutes for a friend. I've always got 5 minutes for a friend. Turns towards her. So can you do that with your practice? Just stop, turn your body towards what you care about, attend fully for 5 minutes. 5 minutes is a long time. It doesn't take a long time to keep a bond strong. To attend, to actually come back, not in a distracted way, but in a full way for 5 minutes is significant. Again, consistently and regularity matters. It matters much more than the amount of time, particularly if you're in busy time of your life. Consistency expresses attention and care, and this care deepens the bond. Be creative and reach out. In other words, don't relegate your practice to a dusty cushion in the corner of your bedroom. practice is hardy, it's adventurous, it's flexible. Open up and think outside of the box. Connect with people in the Sangha, connect with teachers, connect with yourself, connect with your house, connect with the ocean, connect with the compost bin. Always this kind of relationship is based on respect and the sense of curiosity and flexibility. And over a lifetime, it can change. So you might think about, you might take some time to think about your relationship with your practice in terms of these elements of friendship and this guiding principles of emptiness and particularity. And I think this will bring up a sense of curiosity and deepening. And this we live out with gratitude. Thank you very much. Further questions?